Okay, the second aliyah of Parshas Pinchas, you might think it's going to be a challenge to find what to discuss here in this aliyah. It's a very long aliyah, but most of it is names. So one might think that how much is there to say about names? And the answer is quite a bit. There is quite a lot to say about names and about the concept of the names here and about the overall presentation as Mefarshim discussed. So we'll try to just call your attention to some of what's brought up in the context of this listing here. So here, the Aliyah begins, and once again, it's an interesting connection between the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah, that the fact that we're going to have these names is introduced in the first Aliyah, and now we get to the actual listing. So it starts off, Reuven, Bechor Yisrael, Bnei Reuven, Chanoch, Mishpachas HaChanochi, Lefalu, Mishpachas HaPalui. So here, as far as how the names are presented, so the idea of having the hey before the family name, and then the yud at the end, HaChanochi, etc., Rashi explains that this is to emphasize the yichus from both sides, and that it's because there was a challenge, almost the Olam was saying, oh, presumably, they're not really descended from who would seem to be their fathers, because how could you imagine what would have happened in Mitzrayim, where they were under control of the Mitzrayim? Presumably, the yichus is not really coming from the fathers, so therefore, the Torah emphasizes with this kind of formation that this is actually indeed the case. So Steinwurzel, in the Sefer Vayedaber David, comments that the fact that we have this specifically here is perhaps because of the aftermath of the events with Benos Midram, therefore there was the suffix that was raised because of the possibility of immorality, so it needed to be emphasized, and also for the sake of the property division, so it's especially relevant here. And also he notes that the Ramban over here writes the purpose of this count was they should all come in front of Moshe Rabbeinu to be blessed by the power of his vision. So this was also accomplishing this clarifying of where exactly they came from. The Ramban also comments here that you see from the way it's phrased that it's not only the Shlatim that kept distinct, but also the families were distinct and were meant to maintain their family groupings. And the Sefer Shlom Derech of Simcha Levavot Goyim suggests that maybe that's in order to increase harmony, the assumption that the neighbors would be close family relatives also, that would increase the chances for harmony and peace. Certainly a crucial theme for the 3 weeks. Okay, so instead of reading through the whole Aliyah pasuk by pasuk, we'll just call out some of the observations that we find regarding some of the psukim. So if you look, for example, in pasuk ches, it says, Uvnei Falu Eliab. So here, it's one child that's mentioned here, one son, and yet the language is Uvnei. Why doesn't it say Uven? So the Gemara in Baba Basra and Daf Kufman Gimel Veis, I don't know if we'll get that far next year, but who knows. But that Gemara understands from here that you see that even a reference to one son could be grammatically phrased with B'nai. So that's also something to be aware of. And then the next pasuk continues with a little bit more drama. U'B'nai Eliab Nimuel V'Dasan V'Aviram. Oh, they sound familiar. Indeed, yes, who, Dostan de Aviram, Kriye Haida, Asher Hitsu al Moshe v'al Aaron v'adat Korach, v'hatsotsu amal Hashem. Yes, indeed, this is the same Dostan de Aviram that you remember, that sound familiar, that they are the ones who got involved with Korach and to attack God. So the Gemara in Mesachus Megillah, and Daf Yud Aleph and Aleph, the Gemara says that this phrasing is to tell you that they held consistently in their evil and their misbehavior from the beginning to the end, as our Tzimma suggests, it's from the repetition of the word who, that's the extra emphasis rather than the word who, to say, yeah, that's them, those are the ones. And there's an essay about this in the back of the Sefer Sanderach, we mentioned a minute ago. We have a whole essay devoted to Dafan Zahiram and their particular role in having really perhaps been the instigators with Korach and also the ones fighting with Moshe Rabbeinu in the beginning, in Parsha Shmos. And their behavior throughout has always been the type of troublemaking that's associated with a certain kind of personality that gets involved in other people's concerns, and that does so with arrogance, as opposed to the Mida of Nias, Moshe Rabbeinu's Anivus, the polar opposite of Dafan Zahiram, and that's developed at length in this essay in the Sefer Sanderach. But presumably this idea of them being arrogant is also connected to this notion that they held steadfast to their evil throughout their lives because they're not receptive to Musar and they're not receptive to any kind of a correction. So when you see miracles and you see refutations happening of your whole attitude and approach, you still have to be open to it in order for it to make a difference. You have to be paying attention. You have to be watching. And you see that they were not open to it. That's part and parcel of this whole attitude of arrogance. And indeed, they remained uncorrected and unrepentant their entire existence. And this idea of Hatzosim Et Hashem, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Kuf Yud, where the Gemara has the whole discussion of Korach and the apparent prohibition to be like Korach. So there, citing this pasuk, the Gemara says that Kolacholik al Rabo Kecholik al Hashchina, that if one takes issue or fights against his Rebbe, it's like fighting against the Shechina itself. And the Meiri adds that this is an expansion of the normal Isser of Machloket that the Gemara is talking about over there, that we have by itself, but together with attacking somebody who you are appropriately supposed to see as an authority and to respect, so that adds on an additional element, and that is like attacking Kadosh Baruch Hu himself. And that's what the pasuk is conveying. And so then it reminds us of what happened to them. V'tivsach ha'aretz es pia v'tivlo otam v'yetz korach v'mos ha'eda v'achol ha'esh es chamishim v'matayin ish. So the ground opened up, and it swallowed everybody, and it was as a nes. So what does that mean, as a nes? So you could translate that as a miracle. It's also translated as a banner. That's how Shamshon Rafael Hirsch understands it, like a flag, like a sign that is lifted up in order to be a cautionary tale. People should see how not to behave by watching what happened to them. Now that's as far as Dasan Baviram. What about Korach's children himself? That's the next pasuk, Uvnei Korach lo meisu. So Korach's children did not die. That's a literal translation. What does that mean exactly? So Rashi said, Hem hoyu beitza tchila. They were involved in the very beginning. Maybe they were also provoking. Uvashat ha-machlokes, hirhu tshuva b'livam. They had thoughts of tshuva, l'fikach nizbatza lahem, mokam gavoha, b'gehenim v'yashvushat. So therefore, a solid part came up in this whole crack, and that's where they were able to sit, and they didn't die. So the way it sounds like is that basically the earth collapsed, but there was a solid part at the top that they could sit in a protected state. So many commentaries ask that if indeed they did tshuva, so tshuva should work, so they should be saved completely. Why this kind of in-between treatment? So there are many approaches. The Lahar Sassan suggests that this is reflective of the fact that if they were indeed instigators, so they were among the Machtiei Asaravim, they were people who were causing others to sin too. And in that context, you say it's much harder to do tshuva. They must speak and be other lots of tshuva. Therefore, they started the process, but didn't actually get to it, so it's appropriate that they should have at least this level of onesh. The Sefer Yabin Yabin, he says that it was not absolute, and they only did it because they saw the ground opening up. So that's not really a nobly intentioned kind of tshuva, it's more a panic kind of tshuva. So that's still significant, it saved them a lot, but it didn't completely absolve them. And he says, suggests that that's maybe also why when we blow the shofar, we say there's more of a nekarach in order to invoke that kind of last minute reversal and to recognize that even at the last minute, it's possible to change the course of things, and that that message of the sons of Korach is something that, in a sense, could be inspiring. Lubavitcher Rebbe had a sicha where he understood that the punishment is kind of paradox. It's something and it's opposite. He wrote Dabar V'Hifucho, because on the one hand they're swallowed up, but on the other hand they're still safe at the top. And he understands, because the tshuva was limited, and the tshuva was not visible to everyone else. And he's medayik, the strange language in Rashi here, that they had thoughts of tshuva when were the thoughts of tshuva? B'shas ha-machloket. So that sounds like even while they were agitating, they had thoughts of tshuva. In other words, they didn't make it clear to everyone else. They still played along with the rebellion. So it was an internal tshuva, but it wasn't visible to everyone else. So therefore, it makes sense that as far as everyone else can see, they are still swallowed up. But at the same time, internally, they were protected. So those are among the approaches to the question of why were they not saved from the punishment completely. But it's interesting to know, there's a long essay about this in the Sefer Megadim Chadashim, and he points to the Rashba in his commentary to Megillah. According to him, the question wouldn't necessarily apply, because the way the Rashba understands it is it means that they didn't fall in at all, that basically there was a surface at the top that remained solid, that didn't crack, and they were able to stay on to that, and they didn't fall in, b'chlal, so it means they were not swallowed it, and that's what it means to say that they didn't die. You still have to figure out, there are other gemaras that's done differently. It's a little bit of a tricky subject, figuring out exactly what happened to these sons of Korach, but somehow they ultimately persevered. And it's also noteworthy that the Medrash suggests that the reason that they were wrong in the first place is because they felt a conflict, that when Moshe passed by, they were embarrassed. They wanted to show honor to Moshe, but they thought they have to be mechaped their father, and the father is not going to want that. So they kind of were caught in between, which itself also maybe fits this imagery. But it's perhaps also evocative. There's an often quoted sicha of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, where he talks about Eliphaz and other things. Eliphaz, the son of Esau, so he was also caught in an apparent conflict that Esav wanted him to kill Yaakov, and he thought, okay, again I have a spear between the cover from my Rebbe and the cover from my father, what should I do? So I'll just take his money, and that way Ani Chashuk Kemesh. So Chaim writes, it's a crazy kind of cheshbon to make. It's clear that in that situation, you don't follow the father's instruction. But sometimes you have a little bit of good, a little bit of bad, and it's confused. And to be called Or V'Choshech, Mishtamshin V'Erbuvia. You have light and darkness, and they're all mixed in together, so you end up with some very perplexing approaches. So perhaps there's a similar kind of mentality here with Bnei Korach, but it's coming from a good place, essentially. It's coming from the desire to be properly respectful, even if they weren't fully appreciative of just how that respect should be allotted. So ultimately, it prevailed. Ultimately, even if they had to go through some back and forth, ultimately, seeing the whole picture allowed them to come to the right conclusion, and perhaps that itself is some level of inspiration. Okay, speaking of inspiration, so if we go skip a little bit to Yisachar, to Chav Gimel. So Yisachar, we know, is associated with Talmud Torah. So that's inspiration for us. The question, how to pronounce the name. That's really the whole story. So in general, B'cholot HaRekula, it's a question, how to pronounce Yisachar. Whether it should be pronounced Yisachar or Yisachar, or maybe both, or maybe different places in different ways. So some of the approaches connect to this particular presentation here that says, Chof Gimel B'nei Yisachar or Yisachar, Mishpachosam, Tola, Mishpachas HaToloi, Lefuva, Mishpachas HaPuni, Yashuv, Mishpachas HaYashuvi. next pasuk, Lishomer Mishpachas Hashemroni. So Yashuv, so there, we're told that Rashi tells us that this is the same child that was originally called Yov, but apparently Yisachar found out that that was an idolatrous name, so he changed his name and he said, I have a shin that's extra in my name, I'll give you the shin. So then his name became Yashuv. So in the minig and the legend, as Yashuv relates in the Nefesh HaRav, was that up until this point in the Torah is read as Yisachar, and then after this, that's Yisachar, because he gave away this extra sin to Yashuv, so to save him from the idolatrous name, so it switches at this point. It's a fascinating idea. Also, the Or HaChaim has a comment here of Wufuva Mishpacha Safuni, in terms of the imagery contained within words. So Or HaChaim has a whole drasha here about Tapuva, the letters of Peh, Hey, and it's supposed to convey to us that the mouth of the Talmud Chacham is Kodesh, is like a Kli Kodesh, and therefore it really shouldn't be used for anything other than Talmud Torah. And that's the second part of the word here, Mishpacha Tapuni, it's lifnos, that you should clear away anything else. Tarek lifnos mipi, you have to clear away anything other than Torah study. So it's a difficult standard. And it's evocative of the Yerushalmi, that quotes that Shimon Bar Yochai said that if he had been present at creation, he would have requested that he should have two mouths. So he should have one mouth for Torah and one mouth for all the other stuff. But ultimately, that's not what happened. And since we only have the one mouth, so we have to be even more careful, and perhaps that's better, that we shouldn't think that, okay, we have one mouth that we can do whatever we want, and that's not going to be affected. But we only have the one mouth for Talmud Torah and for everything else, so therefore it creates a extra burden of the hearers. We have to be extra careful to make sure that we keep it appropriate. We certainly don't use it for anything prohibited, but even beyond that, that we keep its use elevated and focused, and that's a part of the burden that comes along with it. Okay, so let's skip towards the end, so to go to Mem. So here we have the Mem through Mem Beis. So we have the listing of Binyamin and then Don. This is the Yuvenei Vela, Er Venama, Mishpacha Sardi, Venama, Mishpacha Sanami. I mean, the pasuk really starts back from Amichas, listing off all of Binyamin's children and descendants. And then it gets to Mem Beis with Don. Eilu v'nei Don, Mishpachotam, Mishpacham, Mishpacha Shuchami, Eilu Mishpachotam, Mishpachotam. So here the Chafetz Chaim has a comment, is that if you notice that if you look at the numbers, so Don ends up having 64,400, while Binyamin has 54,600. So Don is more than Binyamin. Even though Binyamin had 10 sons, and Don had one, Nechushim. So you might think mathematically, it's clear that Binyamin has the least, and he would be expected to have many more descendants. And yet you see that it's all how HaKadosh Baruch Hu plans it out, and even if you have the odds in your favor and you think that's going to decide things for you, it's not the way it works. And it's important, Mr. Haskell, in general, because we feel like we have to set up our lives to align with the greatest odds for success. And yes, as far as the decisions we make, so that makes sense. But understand that ultimately it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's decision how things are going to turn out. And that, well, we do the best we can, if things don't exactly follow along those lines, so ultimately it's not based on statistics or odds or keeping your options open or hedging your bets. It's ultimately going to be up to what the Ribbono Shel Olam decides is going to happen, and this seems to be a powerful example of that. Okay, so in Pasuk Mem Vav, let's skip to there. So here there's a famous character, Sarach Bas Asher. Vishem Bas Asher Sarach. So there's a lot of interesting things about her name, how it's spelled, when it's spelled one way, when it's spelled the other way. But the Ramban has a comment here which is based on a Targum which I don't think we have, but the Ramban quotes that already the formulation here is a little unusual. The Shein Bas Asher Tarach, so the Ramban refers to a Targum that has essentially an extra word there to convey to us that Tarach was actually not the daughter of Asher. She was the daughter of the wife of Asher. She was basically a stepdaughter of Asher, which is a little bit tricky, as in the later Sfarim point out. So then who was her father? Was her father one of the other Shvatim? Was the father somebody else completely? Where exactly does he come in? Where exactly does she fit in terms of the whole structure here? But what's still noteworthy is that if indeed she's not his biological daughter, so the fact that she is identified as his daughter is significant, and there's extensive discussion regarding Yerusha and the like, and the Sfarim talk about at length a very practical issue. The Chasam Sofer has a few tshuvas about this, about the question of shtaros and referring to a adoptive parent or a step-parent as a parent could have a major ramification. So a part of the whole discussion is centered around this Ramban and this idea that she is identified by the Torah as being the daughter of Asher when apparently biologically she was not the daughter of Asher. As a Chasam Sofer in a different shuvah, in Aruch Chaim, also talks about this for the purposes of Kaddish, which is relevant to the halachos of Kibbutz Avim. And there he talks about that somebody was an adopted child or a stepchild who wanted to say Kaddish for the parent, and the Avelim would not, the other Avelim wouldn't allow. So the context you have to understand is that if it was that they don't have everyone saying Kaddish, that Kaddish is a precious commodity because they have to take turns, and only one person says Kaddish at a time. So trying to compete with the others, so that creates its own issues. So Chasam Sofer, in that context, he sides with the others that they maintain that this child didn't have to say Kaddish. However, it's also clear that it doesn't mean that it's nothing. That it's certainly, as far as covered and including Kaddish, so it really is appropriate for a stepchild and adopted child to have an attitude of kavod and hakaras hatov, and including Kaddish. It's just that because of the competitive atmosphere, as far as who gets to say Kaddish, the Chasam Sofer says, so yes, it's true that they have a clearer view, and therefore they have the right to control that. But as far as whether it's still appropriate to have some kind of recognition of, and a strong recognition of the hakaras hatov here, and everything that comes along with it, that certainly is appropriate, and that's something that the Sfarim talk about. And we'll just end at the end of the summer, on the last pasuk, with a note of inspiration. It's the pasuk of Eliyahu, and the pasuk of Eliyahu, Eilef Tekudei Bnei Yisrael, Sheish Meos Elef Lo'elef, Lo'elef Shva Meos Ushloshim. The Rebbeinu Bachya comments over here, that here we say this is the number, but it's not really the number of the whole Jewish people. It's only the number of those who fit within the parameter. And in general, we don't really have ever, after this, at this time, a count of the entire Jewish people. And he emphasizes that's true quantitatively, but it's true qualitatively even more so, that we don't really know just how big the Jewish people are, and we don't know certainly how much influence they have. They are above and beyond any ability to count, and their impact on the world, even if they are quantitatively small, is beyond any counting and beyond any numbering, and that is the source of our infinite potential. So that's something to appreciate and to think about, and as we go into these weeks of summer, which are finite, but the potential of what we can accomplish and what we can use this time for is infinite, and the effect that it can have if we take this different kind of pace and we use it to make sure that we stay on a path of growth, and maybe even in a different fashion, a way that we're not able to during the year when we have so many distractions. So that can have an impact on the whole year following and all the time following, and that even that which seems small and finite can contain multitudes. And that's something to internalize and to think about very powerfully as we head into the summer. So I wish you a wonderful summer. Should it be only good things, and we should continue to grow even beyond what might seem to be possible. First, have a great day.